We have one matter for oral argument this morning, and the panel that will be hearing that oral argument consists of myself, Wade Birdwell, to my left. Oh, wait, he's the rookie. I'm sorry. To my right is Justice Mike Wallach, and to my left is rookie Brian Walker.
Four years rookie,
that's true. Okay. But anyway, so we'll be the panel hearing this today, and we appreciate y'all being here. If you would be so kind as to call the case.
The court will now call Cherise Mandanda versus Vital Care. Land free for court. Ms. Taylor Jones, to offer public appellant. Ms. Libby Wheeler, to offer public appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Haley Jones, and together with my co-counsel, Dallas Flick, I represent the appellants, Ms. Sned Decker and CSF Nutrition, LLC. This is an appeal from a bench trial, and there are three issues before the court. First, the appellee below recovered under an illegal contract that is void as against public policy under the Texas Medical Practice Act. Second, the appellee waived its capacity defense for failure to file a verified plea in abatement. And third, the trial court abused its discretion by withdrawing a partial summary judgment ruling after evidence closed at trial. And so my clients were not heard on the issue of their DTPA liability and TBOA liability on their affirmative claims. These are three independent issues, and we are asking the court to reverse and render with respect to the first two issues, so on the illegality of the contract and on the waiver of the capacity defense, and to remand for a new trial on the third issue as to DTPA and TBOA liability and damages. Turning to the first issue, the trial court erred by enforcing a void contract. This court has said in TI versus Cook Children's Medical Center, in an opinion authored by Your Honor Justice Birdwell, that the purpose of the Medical Practice Act is to preserve the vitally important doctor-patient relationship and prevent possible abuses resulting from lay control of corporations employing licensed physicians to practice medicine. And so contracts that facilitate the corporate practice of medicine by a hospital or a clinic are illegal. The contract at issue violates two provisions of the Texas Medical Practice Act.
Go ahead.
Which is housed in the Texas Occupations Code. And those provisions are section 155.001, which states that a person may not practice medicine in Texas without a license.
Okay, so what were they doing? How are they practicing medicine?
They were administering IVs, Your Honor, so needles into arms.
Hospitals, nurses administer IVs every day. Is that practicing medicine?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Well, not according to the Supreme Court's opinion in Andrade.
It is, Your Honor, and Andrade focused on the level of control that was being exercised by the partnership over the physician and found there was no control.
But what about the hospitals? It also specifically said the hospitals can do all the things that they were doing here, and said you have to show more than that in order to be involved in the practice of medicine.
You have to show more control over the physician, but assuming that control is there, he is practicing medicine. And so the question is really, this is a question of control. The physical practice.
Let's go back to the first question, though. What case do you have that says administering IVs is the practice of medicine as opposed to the practice of nursing?
It is first a statutory definition of the practice of medicine, and then the Northern District of Texas, which has said dehydration is a physiological condition. So the statute says that practicing medicine includes the diagnosis, treatment, or offer to treat a physical disease or disorder by any system, any method, or the attempt to effect cures of those conditions. Dehydration is a physiological condition, and the Northern District of Texas held that in Willis versus Noble Environmental Power. They said,
yeah, but you haven't shown me a case yet that says that administering fluids through an IV is the practice of medicine. Do you have that?
No, Your Honor.
Okay,
no
you.
Case has said that administering an IV with that level of detail and granularity constitute the practice of medicine.
Right.
But the definition is quite broad, and it's quite broad on purpose. It includes things like chiropractic practice, and there are certain exceptions in the statute built in that allow for that understanding that it's within the scope of the definition. So the statutory definition is quite broad, and it includes even the diagnosis of conditions. So treatments, we have needles going into arms. That is the practice of medicine. And
what case do you have that says that?
I don't have a case. I'm applying the statutory definition, and I'm using the case that says that dehydration is a physiological, quote, condition. And the word condition is in the statutory definition. So it's that. It's treatment of a condition. And Vitatin does advertise that its products, these IVs that are administered on-site at brick-and-mortar locations, are products designed to treat dehydration. So they market that they are treating dehydration. Dehydration is a condition. The statute uses the term condition, and so this is the practice of medicine. And we don't dispute that nurses are qualified to administer IVs, but the Texas Occupations Code also says that physicians must supervise nurses when they're engaged in activities that may be delegated to nurses. And so that's the crux of this, is the delegation, the degree to which there was delegation. And
would this term dehydration, would you concede that there's probably different levels of dehydration? There may be, I just haven't had a drink of water in the past few hours, so I feel a little dehydrated, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I need to go and see a doctor. Do you agree with that?
Certainly, Your Honor.
And this definition that you're giving us, that equates dehydration to a medical condition, isn't that kind of the reason that these things exist? Because you might have instances where somebody who's terribly dehydrated, they're going to go to the emergency room. But if they're a little hungover or they're, you know, they just want extra fluids, if they will, they show up to one of these whatever you want to call them type facilities. Do you agree that that's kind of why these things exist? Is for people who don't necessarily need medical care.
I agree that there's a distinction with in the level of dehydration that a patient may exhibit. However, a licensed nurse still has to be the person who administers an IV, regardless of the degree of dehydration, and nurses must be supervised by physicians, period. That's not in dispute based on the way the Texas Occupations Code is written, and it allows for...
Doctors don't have to supervise nurses as they're taking care of patients. Show me where in the Occupations Code it says that.
Your Honor, it's in the delegation of a physician's authority, and that provision I will provide on rebuttal.
The delegation provision speaks to advanced nurse practitioners as opposed to nurses in the regular course of business, doesn't it?
It does, Your Honor.
These weren't advanced nurse practitioners, were they?
They were not, Your Honor.
And they weren't required to be, were they?
No, they're not to administer IVs. They're not required to be advanced nurse practitioners. They do, however, Your Honor, have to be. A nurse, for example, cannot set up a freestanding nursing clinic without a physician at the head of that clinic. That is in Section 155001 that says to practice medicine, you must be a licensed physician. The administration of intravenous fluids, and by the way, this is vitamins. This is a product that's bought from a pharmacy. Patients were required to complete health questionnaires. This communications with these treatment providers was subject to HIPAA. All of that is in the trial record. And before receiving the injection, a patient has to submit a health questionnaire that's reviewed by a doctor, Dr. Dill, who is an independent contractor or employee of the appellee. And so we do have a physician supervising this practice. These nurses are not freestanding nurses who are licensed to come and administer IVs without the supervision of a physician.
There's a difference between someone setting up a protocol or setting up standing orders and supervising, isn't there?
Not in this context, Your Honor. Not under the Occupations Code, which requires, under certain terms, delegation of authority, yes, but a hospital can't run with nurses alone, nor can a freestanding clinic that administers IVs.
Doctors have to provide orders for nurses to follow. That you're saying that's a delegation?
It can be, Your Honor, depending on the instruction. It can be. But at the crux of this, at the head of this, there has to be a physician who is licensed under the Occupation Code.
And they had a medical director, correct?
They did, but the role of the medical director, Dr. Dill, is ambiguous in the record. And what these courts have looked at in Watt and Rocket and Flynn Brothers is the degree of control that's being exercised over the physician.
And what evidence do you have of that in the record?
We have the fact that she was a, quote, medical director. There's an ambiguity as to whether she was employed, which is almost per se unlawful under the Texas Occupations Code under Flynn and Watt.
Employee is a lay term, is it not?
There are legal distinctions based on the level of control being exercised.
The record doesn't reflect the terms of Dr. Dill's contract, does it?
It does not.
So we don't know anything about what her relationship was other than she established protocols for the nurses to follow.
We know that she's not an owner, and that's an important fact under the Texian case, which says that this structure might have been lawful, and it is now lawful because the appellee has restructured to a PLLC in which Dr. Dill is an owner. And so the Texian versus KKU case out of Houston addresses that and says that where you have a professional association providing professional services, so long as the owners of that professional association are duly licensed to provide those services, that is lawful. And so that is how the business is now structured after advice of counsel and after my clients raised this issue and said our business practice is illegal. But taking a step back from the ownership of the appellee, if we look at the franchise agreement, the person who is individually obligated to perform the obligation of the franchisee is my client, an individual, and she is not licensed to practice medicine under the Texas Occupations Code. That's beyond dispute. Any delegation of the responsibility to administer IVs under this contract would essentially be a subcontract.
So you're saying that the administration of IVs per se is the practice of medicine?
Within the statutory definition,
okay, so when
yes.
Somebody self-administers an IV, that's they're practicing medicine on themselves? Because that occurs.
Candidly, Your Honor, perhaps. I don't know that the Occupations Code would reach them.
It's not merely just the injection, the use of a needle, okay? Because diabetics use needles all the time. People take their own medicine all the time, but that's not the practice of medicine. We don't put them in jail for it because they're taking care of themselves. Here, you've identified dehydration as a condition, but there's nothing in the record to indicate that literally there has to be a diagnosis of dehydration for the product to be offered, okay? Literally, anybody who just wants maybe to improve their vitamin intake, et cetera, and do so in a manner that's more efficacious than taking some pills, they're a client potentially, and they don't have to be dehydrated. So what was the context of that Northern District case?
Your Honor, it was an ADA case, and it was an employment discrimination case, and the court was considering whether dehydration was a condition that rose to the level of a disability when there was adverse employment action.
Okay, so it wasn't in the context of diagnosing dehydration or anything of that nature.
That's right, Your Honor, but the treatment for dehydration at a severe level that would be received at a hospital is exactly the same as what these nurses were doing here. And so there's no distinction in the treatment for dehydration based on the level of severity. This is fluids that's being administered via intravenous injection. We also have vitamins. We have things going into the bags, Zofran in some instances going into the bags. And so.
But I'm guessing just a bag of saline wasn't on your product list, though.
It was, Your Honor, yes. But
it
if
was.
They.
Okay.
If they have to be administered via intravenous injection, which is required to be done by a nurse who is required to be supervised by a physician, that constitutes the practice of medicine under the statutory definition, which again is quite broad. So yes, Your Honor, this is the practice of medicine. And with my remaining time in my opening argument, I do want to briefly address the DTPA issue and the procedural history there.
Before you do that, I have a quick question. Did your client ever turn away persons because they're not candidates for their product, their services?
That's not reflected in the record, Your Honor, which focused on a few specific legal issues at trial. So it's not reflected by the record.
Okay. Before you run out of time, I do have one question on your last point. Where did you bring that to the trial court's attention to give the trial court an opportunity to correct what you claim to be error before bringing it to this court?
Your Honor, in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, there was a motion for new trial. There was a motion with respect to the findings of fact and conclusions of law that was denied by operation of law.
I did not see that in the record. Can you direct that?
We will find that citation, yes, Your Honor, but the findings of fact were challenged below, and I will provide the direct citation on my rebuttal, but I don't believe that that's contested, that this has been preserved in that way. And also at the trial, an opening statement, their argument was made that this is illegal. And it was, testimony was elicited throughout the case, and so the final.
First point, but I'm talking about the fourth point.
On the fourth point?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor, there was a motion for new trial on all of these bases. And so this has been challenged. It has been preserved in the trial court. And frankly, based on where we are and how we got here, it's not clear what remedy they would have sought from the trial court, perhaps a new trial, which they did seek, which was denied. But yes, Your Honor, they did preserve this issue. The trial court repeatedly emphasized that she was granting summary judgment and then withdrew that summary judgment after the close of evidence. And so when it's withdrawn after the close of evidence, a case from the Texas Supreme Court has considered exactly those facts and said that that is.
The court didn't actually sign a document saying I'm withdrawing anything, did she?
No, but she ruled in a way that can only be construed to have done that by finding that there was no, quote, deceptive act or practice after she had granted a summary judgment as to liability. So in practice, she did, Your Honor. With that, I will reserve my remaining 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Brittany Weaver, and I'm here with Roger Gale on behalf of Vita 10 IV Therapy, LLC.
Jump to one real quick question.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree there was a motion for new trial filed and overruled by operation of law?
I do not see that there was a motion for new trial. I actually just pulled up on my phone the docket to look at the request for findings of facts and did not see specifically a motion for new trial contained therewith, unless it was buried within the appellate points that the parties planned on asserting in this current matter before the court.
I'm talking about a motion for new trial in the trial court.
I did not see one, Judge.
Okay, I didn't either, but.
So, justices and your honors, in going forward, I will not dispute the three issues. I understand the three issues. I believe your honors are fairly comfortable with the issues before the court. We obviously dispute that there was an issue with the contract in terms of illegality. We do not believe that the contract was void because it was illegal on its face. We do not believe that the contract could only be performed in an illegal manner. The contract specifically required that Ms. Snedeker include an RN, a paramedic, or someone with the requisite licenses to supervise the operation, as they knew, as the record reflects, that Ms. Snedeker was not a medical professional or a healthcare advocate that could do these things herself.
The contract provided required the franchisee to pay a medical overview fee to Dr. Dill on a weekly basis, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Were there any were Dr. Dill's duties? I did not see in the contract where Dr. Dill's duties in that medical overview were set out anywhere.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And so what were they supposed to be getting for that medical overview fee that they were having to pay?
And, Your Honor, that was not brought up at trial. That was not something that the Snedeker parties delve into. Truth be told, Vitatin did not go into those details either. We did not believe it was our burden or our position to make the case for the Snedeker parties. The evidence is lacking as to what Dr. Dill did or did not do. They did not provide an expert or any personal experience with Dr. Dill, so that is where we stood in the case.
Was there any testimony that there was no interaction or that he didn't provide the medical overview?
I believe everyone confirmed that Dr. Dill was the medical director, even when questioning Crystal Walterscheid and Lindsay Walterscheid.
My question was, did anybody say Dr. Dill did not do what he was supposed to do pursuant to this contractual term?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so the only evidence in the record is that that was a contractual term, that there would be a quote-unquote medical overview, and nobody contested that Dr. Dill actually provided that medical overview pursuant to the contract.
That is correct.
Okay.
So with regard to the contract issue before the court, we believe that that should be denied, that the contract should stand, and the damages awarded to Vita 10, including attorney's fees, should stand as well. Beyond that issue, we then have the claims against capacity and standing.
Well, before you go there, just quick,
yes, sir.
And it could be in the briefs, I don't remember, but the question was asked to the appellant, do you have law that says that a doctor must supervise those who are administering IVs? on the converse, do you have law that says that other personnel can administer IVs without the supervision of a doctor?
We do. We cite to the Texas Business Organization Code within our brief. It's in a footnote, so I apologize. But we've quoted these sections that state what certain nurses can do under the supervision of a doctor, what certain people can do under a standing order, and also what can be delegated to somebody who is not an RN, whether it be somebody with specific training or experience in this field.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir. So then to the extent that the Snedeker parties claim we did not preserve the issue of capacity, there was no plea and abatement, I would refer to all of the cases cited by the Snedeker parties to show that in those cases, the fact outlines and events are not on point for this case. In this case, we had CSF added to the lawsuit almost a year and a half into the case. As soon as CSF was added, Vita 10 filed its verified denial, challenging the fact that it could or could not sue in the state of Texas because it had not registered as a foreign entity, but also challenged its stance under the contract. I'm aware of the cases cited where standing versus a meritorious defense is at issue when you're challenging somebody's ability to sue under a contract because they are or not a party or interested in that contract. And before going into that, I would just go back to the capacity issue. Each and every case that refers to a verified plea and abatement states that the purpose is to make sure that the trial process is efficient. It is quick and it was resolved in the way it should be. The Snedeker parties were notified of the issue with their Secretary of State, filing or lack thereof. This is not a case where somebody forgot to make a franchise report or payment, their status lapsed, things like that. They had never filed whatsoever. And in response, because this was briefed throughout 91A motions and a motion for summary judgment, the Snedeker parties argued they did not have to file. Not that they needed time to file or wasn't going to be possible to file, but they did not have to file because they believed their agency relationship with Snedeker and Pipes prevented that from being an issue, that Snedeker and Pipes could offer the issues, the damages, the whatever of CSF in their individual roles. So even if the court had abated, we would be a month out from trial, or even after the continuance, 2 months out from trial, stopping the case entirely to see if an abatement would allow them or force them to register with the Secretary of State. And based on the case history, we did not believe that was going to happen. In this case, we had issues. We had issues that led first to a continuance because the parties did not have experts or a damage model 1 month out from trial. We gave them the time to find experts and put together a damage model, and they still not do it by the second trial date. When it came to the scheduling order, the parties did not abide by the deadlines. They did not file liminees or jury demand right until pretrial. And even when we looked at the issues at pretrial, they had not followed the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure for disclosure, for production of documents and discovery. There were so many times in this case that they simply did not comply with the rules. We did not believe an abatement would actually result.
Well, but this is a preservation of error issue, okay? And so under Rule 93, you can file a verified denial, but under the case law that they're citing, it says that that must be, that a motion to abate must be part of that dynamic in order to preserve error. You're making wonderful equitable arguments, okay? And abatement is an equitable remedy, and it's not your remedy. Okay, the abatement would be for purposes of permitting them to cure whatever needed to be cured. The problem is you do actually have a case that says that's what needs to be done to preserve error. So on the distinction of preserving error, are you basically just saying that we should ignore the case law that says that's necessary?
No, I think that this case
there's plenty of equitable bases for the mistrial rule of to preserve error. I've got to ask the trial go away. Nobody likes to do that, but you have to do it. And sometimes you don't do it because I actually have a pretty good jury, so I think I'm going to ignore that. So again, you know, you're making equitable arguments with regard to the actual remedy, but the preservation argument suggests that you needed to do that and you didn't do it.
Yes, sir, and I understand that. I don't disagree with the holdings in the cases that have been cited in both briefs. If you look at those cases, a lot of those cases were dismissed via a plea to the jurisdiction or a motion to dismiss itself. And in doing so, the courts who were reviewing found that the parties who had the capacity issue weren't given the opportunity to cure. Our position in this case is that we did give them the opportunity to cure, that the abatement wasn't necessary. This case wasn't dismissed on a 91A or a motion for summary judgment because of the capacity issue. Instead, we had people who flatly refused and did not want to cure the deficiency going into trial. They had between October of 2023 and February of 2024 to do this. They were on notice, and they essentially invited error in doing so.
On the standing question, I did not see that the trial court made a ruling on standing as to, I'm sorry, the pronunciation, Snedeker?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Yes, as to CSF, but not as to Snedeker. Is that correct?
That is correct. It is only as to CSF.
Okay.
And reading the finding of facts, reading the memorandum from the court when she issued her ruling as trial counsel, I do not read that document in those rulings the same way that I believe the Snedeker parties do. So when you read the findings of fact, after the recitation of parties, finding of fact number 5 is a line item that says there was a contract between Vitatin and Snedeker, not a contract between Vitatin, Snedeker, and CSF, Snedeker as an agent of CSF, or Pipes as an agent of CSF. The court determined specifically that the contract was only between Vitatin and Snedeker. Then as you go down through the findings of fact and conclusion of law, you see that the court determined that neither Snedeker or CSF mitigated their damages if there were any. And there are other various findings where the court goes between CSF and what was referred to as Vitatin Frisco, because it seemed to be there were contracts under the name of Vitatin Frisco, but never under the name of CSF. And there were things done in the individual names of Snedeker or Pipes, but again, not under CSF. And so the court had to parse out what did and didn't happen, what entities were and were not involved. And at the end of the day, when you get to the statement in the findings of facts or the conclusions that they did not have standing and they didn't have capacity because of the registration, I view those as two separate things. Having determined that CSF was not a party to the contract and having determined that CSF did not have any kind of justiciable controversy that would be resolved by this court or any pecuniary interest that would be resolved by a ruling by the court, the judge determined overall CSF does not have standing. It doesn't have a claim anymore. If the contract wasn't there, if there are no damages to support a DTPA claim enforcing the TBOA, then it simply had no claim in the suit at that point. So it goes both to the meritorious defense argument and the standing issue.
Going to the question of the fourth point, how do you interpret a interlocutory summary judgment order that says I'm granting summary judgment as to, quote, liability? What does that mean?
I think that she found that there was a violation of the Deceptive Trade Practice Act for the tie-in statute of the Texas Business Opportunities, whatever it is. I am so muddled at this point. I apologize.
TBOA.
The TBOA. And essentially, and Mr. Gerlich, who was counsel for Snedeker at trial, confirmed the trial is for damages. We are to present and preserve our damages.
Okay, here's my question. If you go to the default judgment case law, it says that a default judgment finds to be true all of the facts with respect to the liability, meaning the negligence, whatever the liability theory is, and it connects the liability theory to the events of the case, that part of causation. But it does not establish causation as to the events causing the particular unliquidated damages being asserted.
Correct.
Okay, so it's kind of a division of causation. If you apply that same rationale here,
which is why the PJC on damages says resulting from.
So to, you know, one could read the interlocutory order on liability to do the same thing, which would still mean at trial you would have to someone would have to produce evidence of producing cause of the violations, and that's what the trial judge said. There's no evidence of producing cause, and I'm just trying to figure out what the meaning of liability is in that interlocutory order.
Yes, sir. And I think that the issue we had at trial was there was an entire day before this trial court of submitting charts, submitting bank statements, submitting explanation as to expenses or fees or loans, and the dots were never connected for the trial court. Even if they could go back and say, I had this expense because of this representation or because of this lack in the franchise disclosure, that harm was not mitigated because we also had that affirmative defense in play before the trial court. And what I think is interesting in this case is that the trial court specifically included in her rulings the fact that the parties, 5 to 10, did not do the disclosures. They did not file disclosures according to the rule, but they provided the information, just not substantially in the same form. So if you focus in, what was the harm created by not putting the franchise disclosure information into that specific form?
What we're looking at is the tie-in language specifically says that a violation of this provision of the Texas Business Organizations Act is a deceptive practice under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I don't know exactly how that tie-in language works, but she finds that there's a violation of the Texas Business Organizations Act, but then she categorically states that there was no deceptive practice by saying there was no misrepresentation or representation of something that would violate the act, okay? So if in fact the tie-in language is being denied in her finding of fact and conclusion of law, then don't you have an irreconcilable conflict between I'm finding this violation of the Business Organizations Act, but I'm refusing to apply the law as it's stated categorically in the DTPA. She doesn't say it's a violation of the Business Organizations Act, which makes it a violation and a deceptive practice under the DTPA, but I'm then going to find that there was no producing cause with regard to that violation and any form of damages. She hedges back and gives us reason to believe what counsel said, which is she withdrew that portion, the DTPA portion of her partial summary judgment motion. So how are we to reconcile that?
And I think that looking at the findings of fact, the judgment, and the ruling together, I believe the trial court looked at this and said, had you presented any damages that were actually linked to the harm that you've alleged as a DTPA violation, whether through the tie-in, under the DTPA.
I understand that, but the legislature has said that's a deceptive practice, period, end of story.
Yes,
so
sir.
So you're effectively arguing that we get to fudge, and the trial court gets to fudge and say, well, the legislature didn't actually mean that when there's not any actual damages. Well, no, they meant it, but they also required there be producing cause of damages. But by mixing up the two, she's created a potential irreconcilable conflict.
And I think at the time, when you look at the judgment and you look at the result, in order to send this back for a new trial, to resubmit all of the evidence, I don't see that changing the eventual outcome. And I have 2 minutes left. But in terms of the issue at trial, the language that you're focused on, the resulting from, the court could not create evidence of damages that resulted from the DTPA violation. The court could not do that for the Snedekers. The Snedekers had to prove that to the court. If it was sent back, we would still have the same issues. It would not return a different verdict.
Well, I don't think we have a crystal ball that shows us what the evidence would be on a retrial.
We know that all of the statements presented at the trial court were in the name of Sherry Pipes, and Sherry Pipes did not have any claims.
We can talk about what the record shows now, but we don't know what the future record would show because we don't know where all that goes, do we?
That is correct, but I think giving the issues presented to the court.
We could actually send it, if we send it back, they could actually cure the capacity issue on retrial.
They could, but I don't believe that there was an issue with CSF presenting damages. CSF did not present damages. Sherry Pipes presented damages in her own name at the trial court. So there were multiple levels of issues before the court that she had to try to decide who was claiming the harm, who was the person that was damaged, and what actually caused that damage. If they showed up, they didn't have spreadsheets, they didn't have bank statements, they didn't have anything to present to the court. The court could not make up a number to give to the Snedeker parties to cure the DTPA violation. In doing what she did with the take nothing judgment, she said there were $0 that you proved to me are connected to this DTPA case. And I don't know that that is reason to find an abuse of discretion or a problem with her final judgment.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Justice Wallach, I want to begin by answering some of your pending questions. I did misspeak. There was not a motion for new trial filed in this case, and I apologize for that. I was thinking of a case I argued on Friday.
I understand that they all merge together at times. So if that being the case, how is your error preserved if it was never presented to the trial court for an opportunity to cure?
Because Rule 21.2 of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure says a motion for new trial is not required in this circumstance. It says, quote, a motion for new trial is a prerequisite to presenting a point of error on appeal only when necessary to adduce facts not in the record. We don't have that here because there is such a clear conflict.
Rule 33.1 says the trial court's entitled to an opportunity of whatever you're going to be complaining about, too, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, but the findings compared to her summary judgment ruling here show that she just simply did not consider the issue. And this is an appeal from a final judgment, not an appeal from the admission or denial of evidence, for example. And so where you have an appeal from a final judgment that is adduced to findings of fact and conclusions of law that we have in this record explaining the basis for her judgment and explaining a direct conflict between the summary judgment and the final judgment, this court is a proper court to remedy that conflict because it came in the form of a final judgment. And so this court can do that under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 21.2, and if this court finds otherwise, it will be the second time that my client is denied process on this issue, because there is the argument from Vita 10 on this point sort of highlights the issue, because there's a discussion about, well, we know if on remand the result will be the same. Not so, because we don't have a record on liability facts. Why do we not have a record on liability facts? Because the trial judge said to Mr. Gerlich, correct, counsel, you are only presenting evidence of damage. And there is a distinction between presenting evidence of injury, which is what's necessary to support a liability finding on a DTPA or TBO claim, injury, as opposed to the quantity of damage. And the quantity of damage was the only question to be answered at trial.
Well, counsel, the violation is not providing the statement that's required by the Business Organizations Act. Is that correct?
Not exclusively, Your Honor. There were also arguments made about deceptive statements about the amount of money that this business would make, the cost that this business would incur, and the projected revenue. And my clients repeatedly asserted that those statements were false and that they were relied on.
Were those made the basis of the motion for partial summary judgment, or was not the partial summary judgment limited to the Business Organizations Act failure to provide the statement, because that was an undisputed fact that that statement was not provided?
All of the summary judgment record includes all of the deceptive facts.
You're telling me that the trial court granted a partial summary judgment on misrepresentations and the other side didn't put on an affidavit saying, hell no, we didn't say that?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but whether the court found a fact issue properly or granted summary judgment, candidly, if I was sitting where she's sitting, I would not have granted the summary judgment. But that's not really the problem. The problem is that she did, and told my clients they did not need to put on all the evidence they could have of the deceptive acts, of the misrepresentations, and then after that changed course in a way that denied them of their right.
Well, ordinarily, as my colleague has pointed out, when you put on evidence of damages, you normally tie it to whatever the wrongful conduct was. Okay.
Yep.
So if somebody was negligent in speeding, I put on evidence of the fact they were speeding because that also impacts how hard they hit me and what it did to my body in the course of the deal. So the evidence of liability normally gets in with regard to the resulting from aspect of that. So the mere fact that there was a partial summary judgment with regard to the misrepresentations, to put on damages, you would have to put on something that would indicate, well, they misrepresented X, and because of that misrepresentation, here's what I suffered. But there's none of that in the record.
Because the judge told counsel that they did not need to go to that level of depth. Certainly, Your Honor, I hear your point that some of it would necessarily have to come in because there has to be a producing cause connection under the DTPA. And, for example, we have Exhibit 11 in the trial record that shows the amount of franchise fee that CSF Nutrition LLC paid.
But you're not complaining. You're not making a legal or factual sufficiency argument with regard to the trial court's finding that there was no damage from a DTPA violation.
No, Your Honor, because there's nothing in the record for us to challenge in terms of sufficiency because of the way that this...
That still was your burden to put on that evidence with regard to the resulting from aspect of your cause of action under both the Business Organization Act and the DTPA.
Your Honor, I see I'm running out of time. May I respond to your
you
question?
May.
Yes, it is the burden to put on evidence of damage. Exhibits 11, 14, 15, 16, amended 58, all reflected the amount of money that CSF Nutrition had spent on this illegal business that the Vitatin represented was a business opportunity, provided a marketing plan, provided a sales plan, provided specific statements about how profitable the business would be, which, by the way, are in the record. So those facts are in the record. And there are specific statements that there is testimony in the record in volume 6 and 7 of the reporter's record throughout, frankly, that
ties. Here's a specific finding by the court that there's nothing, no damages that were the producing, that were caused as a matter of producing cause by any violation of the DTPA, okay? So you bore the burden of proving those damages and the producing cause. You needed to get a yes answer from the court in that regard. And so, therefore, for us to be able to review whether or not the evidence supported the court's negative no answer, okay, you've got to make a legal and or factual sufficiency argument with regard to that. It's a very tough burden because you bore the burden. It's a sterner burden. You have to prove there's no evidence to support the no finding. And then once you find, you show there's no evidence to support the finding, you then have to show that there was conclusive evidence of damage, okay? You don't even make that argument here. So I'm having a hard time. It's almost like you're making a, you're using the summary judgment procedural aspect to make, say, to make a proxy argument on the factual and legal and factual sufficiency argument without actually raising it.
Your Honor, to hold my clients to a legal and factual sufficiency argument when they were told not to present specific facts that would support this claim would be unfair, and that's the problem. This is not a sufficiency argument for a reason, because the facts are not in the record, because the trial judge told my clients not to put them in the record. There is evidence of damage. The fact that she did not find evidence of damage, though, is tainted by the fact that she found, after saying, I don't need to hear about DTPA liability, that there was no deceptive act, no deceptive practice, no violation of TBOA, which is not limited, by the way, to the same producing cause analysis in the same way that a deceptive tract under 17.50 is. And so the withdrawal of a liability finding taints this entire judgment. And certainly one thing is clear, had Mr. Gerlich known that he had a burden on every element of these claims, he would have tried this case differently. And that's the unfairness, is that he did not know that. And so for these reasons, we're asking the court to reverse and render judgment. The contract is illegal and the capacity defense was preserved, and remand on a new trial on DTPA and TBOA liability. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you very much. We appreciate your efforts and helping the court with its discernment and guidance with regard to this, and we will submit the case, and thank you all very much. We're adjourned.
Your Honor.